STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, my dear friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to Reason is the show. I'm so glad you're with me, and I have a line full of people here, and I want to thank them in advance for waiting. I had a fabulous first show, and I'm glad to be able to get to our waiting caller, so let me just do that immediately, and we'll just jump right in. Let's talk with Brian here in Troy, Michigan. Hey, Brian.
The conversation that you were having with Alan. We sure have our work cut out for us to try to get the truth out there and work against all the misinformation.
It is disinformation. It's a huge part of it. It's not even gullibility. I don't even think it's gullibility, Brian. I think that people want to believe this stuff because It gives them a certain kind of. To believe this wildly counterintuitive thing that parts of bodies are not made for things, you know, and hearts aren't made to pump blood. They just happen to pump blood. It follows if you're an evolutionist and a materialist, it's consistent with that idea, but it's so obviously false.
It sure is. But I have a different question for you.
Sure.
Tonight.
Sure enough.
This has to do with God keeping his promises and, we pretty much accept the fact, and I've shared it with others, that God always keeps his promises.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I believe that that's true. However, I've started, due to some personal things in my own life, probably I don't need to go into detail, but I will if necessary. But I've started thinking about the possibility, at least, that God at times, and probably in very rare circumstances, might not keep his promises if he is going to accomplish actually something better than what he had originally promised.
Mm-hmm.
Did I explain that clearly?
It's clear to me. It's basically, you're saying that God finds himself in an ethical dilemma where he's caught between a rock and a hard place, one of two choices, both of which would be wrong when done in isolation. And in this case, they would be breaking promises. But since he's got two promises that are in competition with each other, he can't keep them both, so he breaks one in order to keep the other, right?
That's part of it, yeah. And then I'd like to kind of refine that just a bit. But, yeah, that would be like the first part of my question.
Okay, you know, let me I don't know if you have some particular thing in mind here, but I do have a couple initial thoughts.
Okay, well, I'll just share maybe the refined part.
Okay.
I will share a little bit about my own personal situation is that based on, let's say, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, where we read that God is the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our tribulations.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly have experienced his comfort at times.
Uh-huh.
But I'm going through a time now where I'm absolutely not experiencing that comfort. And one of the other kind of statements that's often made is that God is more interested in our character than in our comfort.
Right.
And so just using that example in my own personal situation, I'm just trying to maintain or uphold God's integrity in my own mind by saying, well, God's not allowing that comfort to come to me because he has something better in mind to replace that. And I'm just trying to find some verification for that.
Sure. No, I'm glad you gave me the specific because the other particulars, which I'll just mention very briefly for the callers, or listeners' sake, they wouldn't apply so much in the situation. What I was going to point out, and I'll just say it in quick summary fashion, is whenever we're dealing with a promise, we always want to make sure that the promise is to me. Okay, which I don't take exception with your citation of the Corinthians passage.
Mm-hmm.
You want to make sure that whatever conditions that are attached to the promise are fulfilled, and so that's a factor. We want to make sure that the promise is in fact a promise and not just a generalization, like you find in the words in the book of Proverbs.
Right.
You know, which are they're general summaries of the way life works. So raise up a child in the way he will go; he will not depart when he's old. Well, that there's exceptions to that, and and Proverbs are understood to have such exceptions. So there's not a violation there. And the question at this point, and then I want to, so I want to say something a little bit more about the ethical dilemma. I don't think that God gets in ethical dilemmas. The ethical, I mean, I could be mistaken about this, but the reason I say this has to do with God's omniscience. It isn't like God is kind of trucking through life like we are and then finds himself in a situation where he's between a rock and a hard place. In a fallen world, we find ourselves in positions where we have competing moral obligations. And in that situation, we do the greater good. So there is a way out for humans in ethical obligation. I mean, ethical dilemmas. We have to, I mean, in principle, we have to figure out what the greater good is. That's the hard part. Yeah. But at least in principle, there's a way to work this out. My impulse is to say that God does not get in ethical dilemmas because he doesn't find himself anywhere. He's not just traveling through life and then he finds himself stuck. You know, I think he knows everything, and so there is no stuckness that he gets himself into. And he, being perfectly holy, is not part in the same way that we are of a fallen world. And so I don't think the ethical dilemmas are going to I don't think he's going to face them. Jesus was in lots of situations, even as a human being, and I guess in principle, I could imagine him caught in an ethical dilemma, but it seems like he was always able to find a way out of the tough spots in a very clever way. I think of the woman at the well as one example, which I actually don't think is scripture, but I think it is an event that actually happened and was preserved in the oral tradition. That's another issue. Okay, but on to your verse. When the scripture says that God comforts us in all our tribulation, I don't take that personally to mean that immediately when we begin to experience the pain, there is immediate comfort. That just isn't what happens, and that isn't what happens in anybody's life, people's lives. Usually, I mean, in this world, you have tribulation. That is a discomforting situation. Okay,
yes.
And so we are experiencing tribulation, and we need. I think that it is our experience of hardship and tribulation in which we learn how to receive comfort from God. Okay, if the comfort was simply dispensed every time there was an inconvenience, there was comfort dispensed immediately, then I don't think we would learn anything from the circumstance. It's like the comfort would nullify the difficulty. I think the comfort is something that God has promised to give, but he doesn't necessarily promise to give it instantaneously, immediately. To a certain degree, these are the kinds of things one has to work out subjectively. So let me just speak of my own life. I have had seasons of very significant discomfort in my life, and have actually been in one for quite a while in a certain set of circumstances. And so I have been deeply distressed, and it's the distress that has driven me to my knees, so to speak. It is the distress that has driven me into the arms of God. So the experience of the distress has driven me into the place and with an attitude where comfort is becoming more available. But it's been a growth process for me. I would say that God does offer comfort in all tribulation, but it doesn't. I don't think he intends to be saying that the comfort comes immediately. It sometimes comes over time. It's not that he promised comfort except for if you got something better to learn, and then God says, okay, I'm going to set aside that promise. I'm going to say no to that promise to say yes to a different promise, which is to make you like Christ.
Mm-hmm.
I think both promises are in play, and there's a process to both of those things. And the as we spiritually mature through the tribulation, the ability for us to experience the comfort of God, even in the midst of that, I think grows as well. I was with a friend over the weekend, had dinner with him, his philosopher Doug Groteis over at Denver Seminary, who's had a tremendous ordeal the last 2 years as he's watched his own wife sink into a kind of a mental illness that what was the word he used to describe it? I might think of it in a minute, but where she's losing her mind essentially and all of her executive functions, and it's like having Alzheimer's, but you're not really that old.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a terrible situation for him to face. But he talked briefly about the issue of suffering being skilled at suffering, and we should be more skilled at suffering than non-Christians because we serve a crucified God who suffered. And so, interesting thoughts. I never looked at it quite that way before. And so there is, I think, when we enter into discomfort, when we enter into suffering, the comfort doesn't always come immediately, because what's necessary is for the experience of suffering to teach us how to suffer well and nobly in a way that brings honor to God. And then all I could say is that in the process of learning that, there is a comfort that comes with it too. But it's not like a pixie dust. Oh, does that hurt? Bang, I'm going to take it away. Here it comes. Mm-hmm. Here's the comfort. The mm-hmm. comfort is available in all our tribulation, but it isn't instantly dispensed. It is something that is experienced. You grow into the experience of it.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it does. And I'm kind of reminded that, it almost seems like I'm being taken back to one of the foundational principles that in all things, God is always good.
Yeah.
And I have to trust in his goodness in order to get through this time of suffering and discomfort and so forth, based solely on the fact that I know he's good, and somehow, which seems totally unclear to me at this point, that he is going to make something good come of this.
Right, right. Well, listen, I sympathize more than you think with your circumstances, though I don't know the details, but what you've just explained, I understand. And I know I have a situation that happened to me many years ago. I was a fairly new Christian, and I went through 2 years of 2.5 years of very, very difficult stuff happening at the end of my 20s, early 30s. And I thought it would never end. I would break down regularly and just weep. And God, when will this happen? And my dear brother Mark would comfort me and say, "This too shall pass."
You know? I've heard that, but it did.
Mm-hmm. And years later, more than a decade later, we started Stand to Reason. And it became clear to me as I looked back on that the things that happened in my life, I won't go into details, but the things that happened in my life were so vital for me to be, to be trusted with the responsibilities I have now at Stand to Reason. Had I not experienced that, I would not be able to be entrusted with this. This is the way I would put it.
Yeah.
So now the thing that I'm in right now, I can look back and I can see at the time, just like you said, now I don't see the point. I don't know what's going on. I don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And we rarely do, frankly, when we're in the midst of it. And this is where trust and obey is so critical. If we knew, it wouldn't be that hard to trust. But we have to trust in God's goodness. And I have the vantage point, fortunately for me, of having had a season of that and then seeing, I think, quite clearly the purpose God had in it. And that encourages me for this particular season I'm in now.
Mm-hmm.
doesn't mean I have a better idea of what God has in mind regarding this season of discipline, but it does it does encourage me to that God knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd pass that on. And before I let you go, two passages I want you to think about. I want you to make note of, if you haven't already, Hebrews chapter 12.
Okay.
And just start at the top and just work down. You'll see it's pretty obvious how it applies. Mm-hmm. And then the whole book of 1 Peter.
1 Peter, okay.
Yeah, I've been spending a lot of time in 1 Peter, and there's a lot there, especially chapter 2, chapter 4, and chapter 5.
Okay,
this
well,
is
good.
A book,
well, I'll
book
pray
written.
For you, and maybe if God brings it on your heart, you can pray for me.
All right, Brian. God keep you, and thanks so much for your
thanks
call.
Thanks so much, Greg.
All right.
God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, that was good. Hard, but good. Okay, let's go to a Christian in South Africa. My goodness, I would have put you at the head of the class if I would have seen that. Hi, Christian.
Hi.
Is that your name, Christian, or are you just identifying yourself as a Christian in South Africa?
No, it's my name.
Okay, nice to talk to you.
Thanks. Yeah, so a friend of mine actually is, I was talking with him, and he said that he's a lawyer, and he said that next month he is going to be on the team arguing for the South African Supreme Court to maintain the illegality of euthanasia.
Right.
And
good for him.
Just talking about. What was that? Did you say I was cutting
out? I said good for him. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. So he's fighting.
Yeah.
He's fighting something evil.
Right. So apparently it's illegal now, but there are people pushing to make it legal.
Yeah, I understand.
So yeah, I was just trying to think. You know, listen to. You know what. The way that they would approach it, and I just wanted to ask, you know, I think they could use all the help they could get. I was wondering what advice you would give in terms of presenting a case for life in that context.
Well, I appreciate you calling. I'm glad you did, and I have a couple of thoughts on it. A lot could be said, all right, but keep in mind that keeping in mind that we are speaking about legal proceedings in the court, one has to be careful how he argues in a circumstance like that, okay? You have to argue not just, in a sense, moralistically, like, what would God think? Well, he wouldn't like this or something like that. But you have to argue in light of the public good, in light of the public good. Okay, so I think the most powerful argument against euthanasia regarding the public good is what happens in countries that legalize euthanasia. And I don't even like the word euthanasia because it means good death.
Yeah.
And it implies that something good is happening when you're taking someone else's life.
Right.
And here's just an aside that you may want to mention, and when I had a debate about this in a secular environment, actually, it's a point that I made. When somebody argues in favor of euthanasia, a lot of times the appeal is put them out of their misery, such as it is, and let them have peace. But to say that euthanasia, killing someone in misery, puts them out of their misery, entails a metaphysical assumption.
Yeah.
Okay, you have to assume that when they die, they will be out of their misery. And that is a contentious assumption. If certain religious views turn out to be true, it may be that you're just increasing their misery, not getting them out of their misery. And for someone to say, well, that's just your religious view, I'll say it is my religious view, but it's also your religious view that you're putting them out of their misery. We are both making religious claims. Now, I am in a position of giving evidence in favor of my claim. I don't see how anybody who says we're going to put them out of their misery can muster any evidence for that. It's a pure faith statement. Okay? So that's one thought. You might just work on that. But the other one that really I think is most compelling regarding the common good is that those people who, with the places where euthanasia has become legal, famously in Holland and some other European countries, and this is happening even in Great Britain, that euthanasia goes from a right to die to an obligation to die. It moves from a right to die to an obligation to die. And this is not a slippery slope fallacy. It is an observation of what already has been taking place in Europe for the last 25 years. And that is, people who have the power are able to take people's lives, or at least pressure them into allowing their lives to be taken. The minute we say that human lives are not the kinds of lives that ought to be protected, regardless of the circumstances, once we take humans off that moral hook, then the circumstances that permit taking their lives can change virtually at a whim. Now, when I say virtually at a whim, I don't mean like overnight, literally, but very quickly. And the slide goes from voluntary euthanasia, which is probably what is in view here, that is when a person wants their life to be taken, to non-voluntary euthanasia. That means when the person does not get to have a say-so. So this could be to a derelict old person who doesn't have their wits about them, could be to a youngster who's too young to decide anything one way or another, could be to somebody who's in a coma. So they're not saying aye or nay. They're not deciding at all. The doctors and family who are responsible to take care of them are making the decision. Okay, and so that's called non-voluntary. But once you go to non-voluntary, it is a very small step, and it has been taken in Holland, for example, and other places, a very small step to involuntary euthanasia. That is, people are being killed against their will. They want to die, to live, but they are not being allowed to. And this is why in some of these countries, and I'm thinking of Wales right now, I did a thing on the radio maybe a year or so, or a year and a half ago, dealing with this, and they give it all nice, fancy, sweet names, like care for the terminal or whatever, care for the unwanted. But care for the unwanted means withholding the care. I mean, it was some kind of euphemism that they used, just like the Nazis did. Nazis had all these euphemisms they used as well. And it's withholding care. And when then withholding care becomes causing, by withholding, they are causing the person to die against their will. And people are just simply not willing to go to the hospital, or they're not willing to send their loved ones or their parents to a hospital because they can't be assured that their loved ones will not be killed, to put it simply. So this is the angle that I would take if I were arguing legally, in terms of the common good. Now, I'm not arguing religiously at all at this point, because this is what happens. Now, your friend will have to, you know, do his due diligence and get the statistics, but it's not hard to come by on this kind of thing. All right? Look, I got to run here, Christian, but I appreciate your call so much.
Thanks.
Okay, all the best to you. Got to go quickly to break. We've got more calls coming up here on Stand to Reason.
Carry STR with you by downloading our Stand to Reason and Quick Reference apps for free. Both are available for iPhone, iPad, and Android. From your STR app, listen to the weekly podcast, speaker podcasts, check out the STR blog, Access Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and more. The Quick Reference app gives you the tools you need to answer the toughest questions Christians face, all through the easy-to-read text and short videos. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. And they're free. So download the apps today and start carrying STR with you everywhere you go.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's Mentoring Letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STRE News from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
Hi, I'm Alan Schliemann. Did you know you can undermine the most recent and common case for pro-gay theology in one step? Find out how to do that in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud. Look for it on iTunes or the bottom of the homepage at str.org.
What's going on? Is everybody on a tiptoe?
Greg Kokel with you here, Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind. I do that every week, broadcast on Tuesday nights from 4 until 6 Los Angeles time, if you want to call in. You can do the numbers from wherever you're at and give us a ring, 855-243-9975. This weekend, Rethink at a North Dallas Community Bible Fellowship in Plano, Texas. I'll be going out there Thursday, but the event starts Friday night and all day Saturday. We're just looking for a fabulous time there. If you haven't signed up, you can still do so. So go to rethinkapologetics.com. Rethinkapologetics.com. The whole crew from Stand to Reason will be there. I think Jay Warner Wallace will be there. Sean McDowell will be there. Scott Klusendorf, will he be there again? I think so. It's going to be a great lineup, and you'll love it. We just did this 4 weeks ago in Southern California. Fabulous, just fabulous. Also, November 13th, Ocean View Baptist Church in San Pedro. I'll be talking about Ambassadors for Christ, the Essential Skills, and From Truth to Experience, which is a kind of a controversial talk. And I'll also be on the 18th and 19th of November, be in San Antonio, Texas at the Evangelical Philosophical Society Conference, Reasonable Faith in an Uncertain World. That's at Trinity Baptist Church. So you can find all the details at str.org/training/events. And you can find Brett, Alan, Tim. We're all there. I know what we're doing. All right, let's go to Daniel in Brooklyn. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, Greg.
How you doing?
Long time no speak, so thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And you just answered one of the questions, because I didn't know that you guys are 4 to 6 now, so that's 7 to 9 for me instead of 10. Oh. So just glad to be on with you.
Well, good.
Talk with you.
Yeah, sure. Good. Okay, so what's on your mind?
All right. So I was getting my hair cut last week, and of course, me and my barber were discussing the lewd comments from Donald Trump, and somehow we got into talking about Christianity, and somebody else had challenged me in the barbershop as well. So the first challenge was me just basically talking why I couldn't vote for Hillary, and I know I don't want to get too political here.
Yeah, that'd be
but
safe
I basically
for me.
Said, no problem. I basically said that just some of the Democratic policies I can't vote for. And I just kept it simple as that. So I was challenged. He said, you believe your Christianity is true. What proof do you have?
Uh-huh.
And my retort was, what proof do you want?
Mm-hmm.
And so he hemmed and hawed that he didn't really give me anything concrete, but I don't know if I asked the right question.
Well, no.
So
hey, this is exactly the recommendation that I gave last weekend when I taught on tactics. And that is
okay.
When, that is, are you still with me? It looks like you got some, are you babysitting there?
No, I am. Yes, I am. I'm actually bathing my 1-year-old.
Oh,
I have my
goodness.
3-year-old who can't sit down in the living room.
Okay. Well,
I'm here, Greg.
Okay. Yeah. Got it. So the person said asking for proof for Christianity, and I think whenever anybody raises the issue of proof, you should always ask the kind of question that you did. What will qualify as proof? That's what you're after. You want to know what that means, because if you do not clarify, then you can give all kinds of information or evidence or proofs, if you will, but a person can always say, well, that's not proof. You know, that's an argument that you're not going to be able to prosecute well if you don't clarify. So I think you asked the right question. What kind of proof do you want? Or something to that effect. Yeah, you've got to get at their idea of what proof actually is. You know, and what you wanted them to do is to hopefully get rid of the word proof, because that's just, I'm not saying you can't after a fashion prove Christianity, but unless those terms are very carefully qualified, it's going to be very difficult for you to rise to the challenge, or me for that matter. So when this came up with me once before, I asked the person, when I pointed out the difficulty there for me, he said, all right, well, how about, can you give me any good reasons why you think Christianity is true? Or that God exists in this case. Now I have something much more useful to work with. Give you good reasons why I think something is true. And that makes it better. Now, of course, he can decide whether it's good reasons or not, but that's a lot lower, a lower standard than the word proof. So I think you did the right thing at that point.
Okay, good. Okay, so now the second challenge in there, so I was talking with somebody else, because she was overhearing my conversation, and basically she asked something along the lines from Matthew 22:14,
right,
where she was basically telling me that he couldn't receive the message because many are called but few are chosen.
Right.
So I had stopped. I didn't give a retort then because I had a feeling that she was taking it out of context. And then I went home and read the context for myself.
Right.
So my question with that, do you, in regards to the context, is there any credence to saying that that some could be called but few be chosen, in the sense that, you know, there may be Christians, but then the Holy Spirit wouldn't use them in a particular fashion or a particular manner?
Well, I don't think that's what Jesus is talking about here in the context. He is talking about he's given a parable, but he ends the parable by referring to condemnation, and that people who were invited to the wedding didn't come properly dressed, and so then they were thrown out of the wedding. And into a place of wailing and gnashing of teeth. And then he says, next verse, for many are called, and this would be parallel to being invited to the wedding, but few are chosen, that is allowed to be stay at the wedding, okay? So he's using the parable to make a theological point, which theological point is summed up in that verse 14, many are called, but few are chosen. Now, was this person who made this statement about Matthew 22:14, was she a Christian making a statement regarding the rejection of your message by the non-Christian?
By my barber. Yeah, and that's the odd thing. So she actually is a Christian. I actually went back to her late last week, and I'm going this Friday for my haircut again. So basically, what I tried to boil it down to was that I disagreed with her application of the scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very difficult because I don't want to be so harsh.
Yeah.
Because I could have just told her that your view is nonsense, but then that would have caused the
I think this is part of what Jesus is saying here. You know, he is talking about, look, I think he's broadly referring to Jews. Jews are called, okay, but they're not responding properly, okay? And so they're the ones who are thrown out. They are on the invited list. In a certain sense, everybody's kind of on the invited list. But then they reject. They don't come properly. They don't do as they ought. They don't approach it in the right way. And so they are rejected. And so I think, just like it says here, for many are called, but few are chosen. Now, there's a couple of ways you can take this. You can take it kind of in a Calvinistic sense that this is election, or you could just simply say, just because you're invited to the party doesn't mean you get in. You got to satisfy the requirements to get in, okay?
I like that.
These didn't satisfy the requirements to get in. And there's a sense in which I think when you said it at first, it didn't make sense to me. And then I realized, oh, she's probably a Christian trying to encourage you, saying, yep, there, he's called, but he's not being chosen because he's not doing what he ought to do. He's shining it on and walking out. And so I don't have any trouble with the way she used the verse, at least the way you described it.
Well, I don't think she was applying it to him, though. She was applying it to me.
And
that's where I had my reservation.
That you are not the chosen one, but you were called, but you're the Christian.
Exactly right. So,
well, you know, probably.
That was. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you probably might ask her next time you get your hair cut. You know, you said many are called and few are chosen. What did you mean by that?
Ooh. Right.
If it's unclear exactly who she's applying it to, because I thought you were talking to somebody who just kind of shined you on, right? And dissed you or something. And she's a sister in the Lord saying, well, brother Daniel, many are called, but few are chosen. And so she's trying to cheer you up, but she didn't mean it that way. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, well, you ought to give her, check it out next time you talk to her and see what she actually meant by that. And then maybe give me a call and we'll chat some more, okay?
Sounds good, Greg. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, have a good time with your kids there.
I got my hands full.
I hope your wife is happy with your good husband, Papa, taking care of the kids.
Well, I forgot the show where you talked about my pa. But my wife is working. My wife is working the evening shift. So
I got
not only do I have the duties of taking care of three children, then I have to clean house and everything.
Man, all right.
A nice clean
well,
house.
You're quite there a guy. Good for you, Dan. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Sure. Bye bye now.
Bye.
Let's see. I'm just looking at the clock. Let's see. Yeah, I'm going to take Joel real quickly here. Joel, thanks for watching for holding here on the line. Greg Kokel, hi. Joel. Just lost Joel. How did I do that? I don't think I pushed the wrong button. I might have, but I don't think so. All right, well, let's take a break. Oh, here comes Joel again on the line. Is that Joel on line one? Yeah, it looks like it. Yeah, line one. Okay. My bad. I guess I put him on hold. I'll get him. Line one. Okay. Joel.
Hey, Greg.
Hey, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to dump you there. It was probably my
fault. No, that was actually my fault. Because
oh, okay.
I went to go take you off speaker so I could talk to you. And,
shame on you, Joel.
Yeah, shame on me. So,
okay, what can I do to help you?
I've been listening to you for about a year and a half, first time calling in, but I wanted to talk to you about advanced medical directives.
Uh-huh.
My wife and I redid our will about a year ago, and after listening to your last couple callers, I think I know what you're going to say, but one of my my basic question is, is it right to take decisions out of critical care, take the decisions out of my wife's hand and say, at such and such point, basically let me go.
Mm-hmm.
We have all these advances in technology, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on, years ago, we may have starved to death, or we may have suffocated because we don't have the advances that we have now.
Right.
And I just wanted to get your thoughts on what about making those advanced medical directives versus having your wife or spouse, be the one who has to go through the difficulty. I mean, you talked with the other gentleman about, difficult times and, having her be the one to go through that difficulty.
Right. Well,
make the hard decision.
Yeah, let me toss this out to you. The purpose of an advanced directive in part is to cross difficult roads early on. It's to cross the roads early when you're of sound mind, when you're thinking carefully, when you have good counsel, and you're not under duress, okay? So if you are talking with your wife and other people about potential conditions in the future, You can come to a conclusion now and make a directive in advance. This is why they call it an advance directive regarding how the medical community will care for you. Okay, if you don't do that, it becomes a burden on the people around you, and especially your wife, if she survives you, to make decisions that are going to be much more difficult to make on her own under duress, the duress being your illness.
Right.
So I think the moral responsibility is to make the advance directive, not to take the responsibility out of your wife's hands. Frankly, I don't think the responsibility is in your wife's hands. It's in yours. And you can make a decision with your wife in advance about these particular things, but I think it's wise to do that so that when the time comes, she knows what you want. It's been agreed on beforehand, and she doesn't have to struggle with making a decision when she's under duress and maybe not at her best. So it's an act
right.
of kindness for your wife. It doesn't mean you leave her out because she could be part of the decision-making process for the advance directive. But I don't see any difficulty at all with that.
Okay. I guess maybe to clarify, one of the things I'm trying to struggle through, you know, even though we have it, we've set it up, but, you know, I make amendments mm-hmm. if need be, is the question that I was talking about. You know, we have these advances in technology
right.
where, you know, 50, 100, I don't know exactly how many years ago, but we would have starved to death, we would have suffocated because
yes.
we don't have those technologies. And that we had a family death recently where it was really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And it was her father and his body kept having heart attacks and bringing him back. And, you know, at what point do you, I guess I'm getting your thoughts on, you know, what's the, and I'm, you know, at what point do you say, you know, enough is enough, or I
right.
guess, what are your thoughts on?
Well, there are.
And that's what I'm trying to get some, I guess,
sure, let, right,
clear
let,
counsel.
Right. Let me give you a couple of thoughts that might help you. And I'm going to just recommend an author right now. His name is Scott Ray, S-C-O-T-T, last name R-A-E, Scott Ray.
Okay.
He's a friend
okay.
and colleague. He's over at Biola University at Talbot in the philosophy program. There is one of my teachers when I worked on my MA in philosophy. And so he's written extensively on these kinds of things. So you can look at his body of work and decide what you'd like to, maybe a book you'd like to find. But I'll tell you, there's two categories here that are important to keep in mind. One of these issues is the distinction between medical treatment and care, right? Care is giving people, human beings, the kind of thing that any human being needs to stay alive.
Right.
Okay, that would be air, water, and food. Okay, air,
right.
water, and food. And probably some measure of personal contact. Yeah, I mean, because that's pretty important, okay? So medical treatment is that which is treatment, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In my view, you are obligated to provide care. You are not necessarily obligated to provide treatment. And there's this different set of standards there. Now, treatment is medical treatment, in order to be justified, it has to have some reasonable expectation of benefit. Now, there's a little fudge factor here because somebody's got to make a judgment of what is reasonable and what a benefit is. A reasonable
yeah.
expectation of benefit, but we're talking here medical benefit, not quality of life benefit. That's off the table.
Okay.
Because that's the thing that kills a lot of people, you know. Well, we don't think they'll have a good quality of life, and so this Down syndrome baby, we're just going to let it expire on the table and not give it food and water
right.
and let it die, you
right.
know. But yeah. But that's not it. That's the wrong criteria. So you want reasonable expectation of medical benefit without creating an undue burden. Now, again, this is another phrase that seems to be That's a little harder to define, but the burden here, I think, is the burden based on the individual, not on other people. Oh, they're a burden to me, so I'm getting rid of them. No, it's the burden right. on the person. Now, if a person is let's say somebody is terminal, they have all kinds of things going wrong with them. They got terminal cancer.
Right.
A lot of times they'll say there's a DNR, do not resuscitate. If they code, right. they just let them go because you revive them to die of cancer shortly after. So there's not a reasonable gotcha. Expectation of medical benefit there.
Okay.
And it creates an undue burden on that individual, bringing them back and letting them, all that other stuff. And so that's the rationale there. So the issue of technology is an important one because some things that used to be seem to be undue burden with regards to feeding and hydration, etc., are not so burdensome now. They're invasive in ways that would have been considered unusual in the past. And I just learned some new things recently of a friend whose child is severely disabled from birth, and they're doing things that feeding through a trach, and sometimes mm-hmm. using a breathing machine to help the child breathe, though not all the time. Some people would say, well, that's using a breathing. They're breathing for you. Well, yeah, they are. You know, just like a pacemaker beats your heart for you, kind of thing, or helps right. to do that. So. This idea of a reasonable expectation of benefit and undue burden, I think, are helpful even in those cases. All right. So mm-hmm. at some point, an individual's got to make a decision what side of the line they're going to, you know, what they're going to do given a certain circumstance. But I think that those categories that I've just offered, and I'm going to have to run here and get to a break
sure.
so I got some more callers, but I think those categories, distinguishing between medical treatment and human care are mm-hmm. valuable. You want to always give human care, even though the medical treatment may not be justified. And then you want there to be a reasonable expectation of benefit to the patient. And that's not a quality of life benefit, but a medical benefit, and does not create an undue burden on the patient.
Okay.
Those are the kind of things that you'll find Scott Ray working out a little bit more. And frankly, even Christian ethicists sometimes draw their line at a little different place. That's where you have to do the best you can. But I think it is right for you to have an advance directive to take that burden off your wife. You do not want her to have that. Okay.
Right. That's what I've tried to do, but I just tried to work out.
You're on the right track. Yeah, you're on the right track, Joel. All right.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for the call. Let's quickly go to break, and then we'll get our last callers here. No, you don't want me to do that? Okay. Well, okay. All right. We don't need the break. We'll just go keep going. We got three people on board here, and let's do that. So let me find the right button. I don't want to dump anybody. Let's see. Four. That's a four. That's Tom in Greeley, Colorado. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Glad to chat with you. I just came from Denver 2 days ago.
Yeah, I was there.
Oh, okay.
You met me and my wife and my daughter.
Okay. All right. Well, good. Nice to talk to you again, Tom, old buddy.
Well, my daughter, who was with us this weekend, is starting a dialogue with a good friend of hers that attends a different church, and she has been invited. Well, she's actually gone to this church with her friend before, but she's been invited back, and she was looking at the statement of faith of this church, and one of their items in the statement of faith says that they believe that the United States and Israel are one, that the current state of Israel is the house of Judah, and the United States is the house of Israel.
Uh-huh.
And that those two houses will be reunited in Christ at some point in the future.
Well, I agree with the second point because there's prophecy regarding that, but I certainly don't see why anybody would think that the United States of America are the lost tribes of Israel. The
right.
10 lost the Northern Kingdom. And I'll just tell you, I can't get into a lot of detail on this, and partly because I'm not that well versed in it, but I know I've seen this before, and it's never worked out good, okay?
Right.
A lot of goofy groups that make this claim. Why people are compelled to do this? First of all, I don't even know how they can do this. Presumably, Americans are Jews. If they mean literally that we are the descendants, then we're all Jews. We're descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which is just ridiculous. There are Jews in America, but there's a massive numbers that aren't Jewish.
Correct. Yeah.
They're from all other nations of the world. Now, they may mean that we are spiritually the northern tribe, so that as a multifaceted, multicultural nation, which, by the way, who can deny that? You know, we are a multicultural nation, and with people that could not possibly be, it seems, descended from Israel. It might be that they think, well, we are spiritually the northern kingdom, and we will be united with Judah, the nation of Israel, you know, at some point in the future. I don't know the justification for that either. So that's all goofy to me. And if I saw that in a church, I wouldn't go back.
Right.
It's just too weird. And then it makes me wonder, what other weird things do they believe in?
Well, there's some other things on there, too, that makes her a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But,
what is the appeal what is the appeal for her? Is there another place that she can go, or is that like the only church?
No, I mean, my daughter's not. She's not really enticed by it. In fact, she says, I don't agree with that. And so she's just trying to start a dialogue with her friend about it. And, of course, her friend grew up in this church, at least for part of her childhood,
uh-huh.
and has kind of been socialized along those lines.
Right.
So she just wants to have a dialogue with her, but to do it in to be a little bit informed when she goes into that dialogue. So.
Yeah. Well, I can't if I would. Here's the way I would put it now, that the burden of proof is on the other side to make the case that the United States of America is the northern kingdom of Israel that's been dispersed. I think it's going to be very difficult to make that case. And first, one would have to ask, do you mean that we are literally descendants of the same people, or do you mean that we are the nation as a whole is the spiritual Israel that God had in mind? If the first, I don't know, I have heard people try to make the case that we are the Anglo-Saxons were somehow the lost people of Israel, but the Assyrians dispersed them. So these people went all over the place, not just to England or to Western Europe. And the United States may contain, even if that were the case, it would only contain some members of the Anglo-Saxon race. We are wildly diverse here. So to say that the nation as a whole is somehow Israel, I think is way beyond the facts. So I would encourage your daughter to get clear on their claims, what the claims are. That's the first thing. What do you mean by that? And secondly, what the reasons for their conclusions are. All right?
Okay. Would you say that I'm just trying to get my train of thought here, but would you say that this is probably coming from – I looked online for a couple of things, and I know – also have the Apologetics Study Bible,
mm-hmm.
and there's a article in there on they call it the Christian Identity Movement, or it used to be called the
Anglo-Israel or something.
Anglo-Israel, like, British Israel, that kind of thing.
Right. That's right.
Is that where these kind of ideas come from?
Well, this is what's familiar to me. Again, I haven't traced that back so much, but I think it's part of that. I think it's part of that. A part of that broader movement. So, look, I got to run, Tom. I got some other callers on board I want to get to, but thank you for the call. I hope the comments helped you a bit. Let's go to Japan. Oh, my goodness. Tim, you've been holding for so long. Thanks for your call.
Yeah. A few weeks ago, you mentioned the fully gifted creation idea.
Right.
About how amazing it would be that the Creator could set things up so well that it would just naturally unfold.
Right,
you know?
Uh-huh.
And, from the standpoint of, that would really be make God even more grand if you could do that type of an idea. It sounds to me more or less like making a square circle or something like this that's impossible, because even for God, because they have to have information, humongous amounts of information stored someplace.
Yeah.
If you're gonna have after the Big Bang creation event, you just have hydrogen and
right
and just energy and matter,
right?
But the information has got to be stored someplace, right?
Yes, what you've touched on is the Achilles heel, and or at least one of them, of the fully gifted creation, which, by the way, is just a way of characterizing theistic evolution. The term was used by Howard Van Til, I think is not even a Christian anymore. He used to be at Calvin College, but he advanced this idea of a fully gifted creation, and it entailed the notion, as you said, the grandness of God or the greatness of God, that he can set things up just so from the beginning that you tip over the first domino and then everything falls in its complex pattern to develop into the life we have today, and which then from an observer on the outside would look like Darwinian evolution. Okay, and the problem is there really two ways to look at this, or two aspects of this. If you look at the Big Bang, it seems very clear that the initial conditions for the cosmic event called the Big Bang were so finely tuned that they, over a period of time, just like a very, very sophisticated thing of dominoes, fell in just the right way to produce the Earth that we have it in the place that it is at the time in the development of the universe and the solar system to make a perfect habitation for life. And that, I think, can be explained in a fully gifted sense, simply because the physics are fairly straightforward and can be, if you set them up in advance like dominoes, boom, they all fall just so. And this is an argument, actually, that we've used for God called the fine-tuned constants of the universe, and also the fine-tuned parameters of our solar system and the Earth, okay? But when you get to the first living thing, when you go from dead stuff to living stuff, this requires a massive infusion of information that is not resident in the physics of the universe itself.
Right.
And therefore, there has got to be an intervention. This isn't a mistake of God. This is just part of a plan of God. It doesn't mean he's not as great. It means that certain things function certain ways given the physics of the universe that God created. And so to make life, he makes life. And he intervenes at some point with adding information. And what that looked like if you were standing there, I don't know. But it seems clear that even for the most simple life form, you have to have massive amounts of information. You have to have genetic code. And then for subsequent forms, you have to do the same thing. Genetic mutation and natural selection are not going to be adequate to do the job. So there's the quick study here, Tim, in Japan on that question. But I think it does sum it up really well. So I hope that answers your question. And we're all out of time here. So thanks for the call, and thank you for being part of Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel. Go out and give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.